Anisha, welcome to Brand Game Strong.
Hi.
It's so exciting to have you today.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited you're here. I want to share this because I feel like it's a good way to start this episode. But I feel like the audience has brought you here, actually.
That's crazy to me that people have asked for me to be here. That's surreal, and I feel really grateful for that. So thank you whoever said they wanted me on here, because I just feel so privileged to be here.
I remember I did a poll a few months ago, and I'm always kind of just like reaching out to people being like, what do you want from this? And I find it's such a passive place to be, because it is such a chill environment that I don't always get like the most productive replies. So this time it was like, Anisha, we want Anisha. And I was like, okay, yes, we are bringing Anisha. And then I realized we were connected on social media, and then I reached out. How has your week been? What have you been up to?
This week's been intense, actually, with work calls about like different artistic projects I'm running, working on a new homeware collection for my brand. So that's like slowly been bubbling away, very slowly bubbling away, but I finally feel like the pieces and designs are coming together. So just like a week of juggling. I feel like it's just purely been a week of juggling. And then I've just driven down this morning from Derby to be here with you. So just a whirlwind week. How about you? How's your week been?
It's been an interesting week, actually, because I've aligned a lot of recordings this week, more so than usual. And I thought I'd be overwhelmed, but actually I'm just having a lot of fun. And I feel like, you know, it's summer in September, which is unheard of in London, strap it up. But no, it's been really good. And you mentioned that you've driven down from Derby. So tell us a little more about, like, how has Anisha Palmer, London, ended up in Derby?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm a Wembley girl, Northwest London girl. Grew up in Wembley, and I moved to Derby about 6.5 years ago when I got married. So my husband, he works in Derby as an engineer, and I was working kind of freelance, self-employed when we got married. So I made the big move to a small city, which was terrifying, not knowing anybody, being a London girl, used to the busyness, used to jumping on a train, going to an exhibition, going to an event, going to a market, friends, family, everybody being in London. So moving was big for me, and I was initially like, I really didn't like it. But I think as soon as I found my people, as soon as I was able to go for walks in nature and just have time and space to think, it slowly started feeling like home. I felt like we created our little bubble and our little safe space. And I'm so grateful for that, to be able to have that and come back to London. Parents are still here, work here, tap back into that London busy energy and take it back with me.
Do you look forward to going back to Derby once you've had a stint in London?
Yes. It's almost like when I get on the M1, I do a massive exhale and I'm like, home is Derby now for me. And for the first, I'd say for the first 2 to 3 years, London was home, but now home is definitely Derby. Home is where my heart is, in Derby, where Vic is, my dog Raja is, our actual home, just feeling, like I said, a safe space. I think nurturing that, creating that together has been really special.
I'm so happy to hear that, because I know like a lot of people, myself included, struggle with change. And for me, I've been in London for 12 years and I can't imagine myself moving, just uprooting. Like I just don't know how people do it. But also it's really motivational to hear that you've kind of found your place there, and maybe we are more adaptable than we realize.
I was the same. I was like, I never saw myself leaving London. It was so ingrained in who I am, what my brand was, what my work was. I never thought I'd leave, never. So the fact that now, looking back at the journey of being there and feeling like it was the best thing I ever did, crazy to me. But yeah, we are super adaptable, and sometimes things work out for the best.
I like to think that as well. How has your business, running your business, changed when you moved it from London to Derby?
Massively. I almost gave up. Genuinely, I almost gave up. So you know, I started my brand in London. I started at Spitalfields. That was the first market I did. I sold one piece for £20 and I thought I'd made it. Wow. Like, someone out there has a piece of my jewelry, and it was just the best feeling in the world. So that was like me living at home with my mum and dad, having my own little studio space in my bedroom, going to markets in and around London, and then winning a competition as a young designer to show my collection in Paris, built my wholesale stockists, and like I just grew exponentially. And then I moved to Derby, and I couldn't get on a train and go to a market and see my regular customers anymore. The financial stability I had through my brand changed massively. I got a job. I would say I went from like freelancing as a designer, designing for other brands, working on my brand, kind of living the dream as like a, you know, 22, 23 year old, and just being like, yeah, this is it. I've made it. And then moving to Derby was really tough for me. Not knowing anybody, not having friends, not having a family, the business not working in the same way. And I worked in marketing and PR for like a travel marketing company, where I was representing like places like Uganda, where my mom was born. And for me, that was amazing, but it was also soul destroying because I had a horrible boss who was sexist and racist. I was the only person of color in that office. And yeah, it broke me in so many ways. But I was like, financial stability, I'm married, I need to have all these things in place. And I was trying to keep my brand going at the time, and I almost gave up. And one of the kind of pivotal things that I think is so important to share is, you know, my husband Vic had a really terrible accident. It was life-threatening accident, and you know, he's fine now, touch wood, all good. But it was a massive shake up for me and both of us, where I was like, Vic, life's too short, and this is all I want to do. Being a creative makes me so happy that I cannot imagine doing anything else. This is what I was born to do. So I just want to do it full time. And he was like, Anisha, just do it. Go for it full time, see how it goes. And then for the last 3.5, 4 years, this has been my full-time job, and I've never looked back. This is all I want to do. So yeah, it was a massive wake-up call for me to just be like, this is what makes you happy, and this is your purpose. This is what you're born to do. So don't give it up for financial stability, because that's come, you know, eventually through my work. So yeah.
Oh, wow. That's just... It's kind of interesting, right, when you hear... And like, I guess you have these experiences where like life has completely shifted and it's kind of changed the fundamental things that you believe to be true, you know, or permanent.
Yeah.
And it kind of, that's the thing that then forces you to do the thing you love. And do you feel like we need to go through these experiences in order to have a shift? Or do you think we can do it through just having that realization on our own?
I think everyone's on their own journey. Everyone's on their own path. My business and brand journey by no means has been like this. I've been here where I've got the stockists, I've got the big names, I've done it all, I've been in Vogue, I've been in Elle, and then it plummeted. And then I slowly built myself up, but way more authentically. So my journey's been tough, you know, 8 years of running Anisha Palmer London. On and off, giving up, you know, personal life taking over, mental health struggles, all those things. But I wouldn't change it for the world, because it made me a stronger person. It made me develop my work and my brand in such an authentic way that has a real purpose now that it didn't have before. My journey is my journey, and I love that. And everybody goes through their own, you know, struggles. Some people are overnight sensations and that works for them. That's not been my journey. It's been slowly hustling and you know, chipping away at the crux of what I'm really passionate at doing. So yeah, I love that. I love that for me.
Love it for you too, Anisha. What actually struck me when you said that some people are overnight successes, I think that doesn't take away from the fact that like their graph is also like this. It's just maybe it started at the top and then it will, you know, life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And we, like I said, we don't see everybody's struggles either.
Yeah.
Some people seem like overnight successes, but we don't see all the hard work mm-hmm. that it took to get up to that point. So yeah. Yeah, mm. totally. Not taken away from that at all.
Yeah. And we spoke about it earlier, didn't we, just before, where we were saying that, like, you can so easily look at somebody and you're only seeing, and we all talk about it, you see the highlights, you know, but like the absolute, like, down in the dumps moments and, you know, all of those. I think we absolutely all go through those, and it's just having grace for that, isn't it? And
yeah, totally.
I think on the surface, I mean, you look like you're absolutely killing it. And I want to congratulate you because you've gotten yourself out of that place and redefined yourself. And I think that takes a lot of energy and a lot of courage.
Yeah. So. Yeah, for sure. I think I'm proud. I am proud of myself. I find it really hard to kind of own how far I've come and just, you know, and not like shy away and be like, no, but it's true that I am proud. I am proud of myself. It's been, kind of 10 years of working in industry, building the brand, and most recently, like, you know, working on projects around my artistic practice and jewelry and identity. So yeah, I'm proud of what I'm doing now. And I just hope, you know, I can continue to do it for a really long time.
Mm. Yeah. You know what's funny? In these interviews, we always start with like the childhood and like going back. And we've gone straight into your work.
I know.
All I can see is your earring. And I just keep like thinking about your work. And I want to ask you, like, what actually is Anisha Parmar London? Because I don't know if everybody will know.
So in terms of what I do, all the different aspects of what I do. Mm-hmm. So Anisha Parmar London has changed morph, but essentially it started out being a jewellery brand inspired by, I guess, my lived and learned experience of the South Asian diaspora, growing up in Wembley, going to Ealing Road with my ba, my grandma, walking up and down, hearing the music blaring, going to the mandir, seeing her jewellery, seeing my mum's jewellery, and kind of like encapsulating that experience of me growing up in Wembley, but in a piece of jewellery. So taking the patterns, traditional motifs and patterns we see growing up and in our mum's saris or jewellery pieces, but modernising them, making them more graphic, using unusual materials like woods and acrylics to give you that pop statement earring. So you're wearing something that hopefully represents who you are, that makes you feel bold and confident and badass when you put it on. And that was what is still what Anisha Parmar London, the jewellery brand, is about. But I guess, like, if I think of Anisha Parmar London as like a house or a little home, now there's different branches coming off of that where I'm working as a project producer, doing community projects, getting culturally diverse women together to talk about jewellery adornment in museums, in galleries, where there's objects from all around the world that are rooted in colonialism and empire. And we're talking about, you know, how these pieces traveled, why are they here? These objects are being worn by these women for the first time as an act of reclamation of our history. And it's kind of taking that crux of like using my story in my jewelry making to now hearing other people's stories and giving them a platform and creating a safe space to think about how we can use jewelry as a mode of storytelling, of decolonizing, of reclamation, and telling our stories in spaces where traditionally you never saw us represented. So now I'm working with organizations doing projects around that, so photo shoots, videos, films, collaboratively working with other artists who have like lived diaspora experience. I guess now I'm a artist, producer, curator, as well as running my jewelry brand.
So you're basically a multifaceted creative.
Yeah I guess so.
I think they call it now a portfolio career.
Oh, wow. Wow. That sounds very profesh. I don't know if that's
it
me.
Is. But I love that you just said that because actually, yeah, all of us just feel like, what are you doing here? And I don't think that goes away, does it? Yeah. I mean, you've been running your business for like 8 years roughly, isn't it? So how, like, do you feel like your own internal, you know, views of what you do and how you do it and whether you're good at it, do you think that's changed over the years?
I think I've become more comfortable with who I am. I think I've really struggled with confidence and imposter syndrome. And I think it's just like we were talking about this in the last couple of years, I've really began to become more comfortable in myself and who I am. And with that has grown, that confidence has grown in my work and what I do. I really, really believe in the work that I'm doing, in the hope that it's making difference, whether it's to somebody wearing my piece of jewelry or whether it's the community projects that I'm doing. Like the purpose has got stronger, and with that I believed in myself more. So yeah, I'm not you know, people say fake it till you make it, and I think I did that a lot in the beginning, and now I feel like it's just, there's the comfort and ease that comes with the work that I love doing, which is really, really nice. Not in like an egotistical way, more in an authentic way, maybe.
Yeah. There's a groundedness. And I think that comes across in your work, because I think you do dig a lot deeper now, in whether it's in your storytelling or even if it's in your designs. Like, they're very intricate and they're very unique to you, which shows that you've actually spent time thinking about it rather than just being like, oh, what's going on outside? Oh, let me replicate it, or let me find a way to make it a tiny bit better and stand out a bit more.
And I've done that. Don't get me wrong. I've done that. And those are the collections that I've not done well. I remember when I moved to Derby, I had a show booked that I paid for that was a lot of money. I risked, you know, a lot of money to do it, a trade show in Paris. And it was that collection where I was trying to fit in, trying to become more commercial. The Paris terrorist attack happened at the, you know, just before the show. So a lot of the buyers weren't coming, but the buyer feedback I got is, Anisha, this isn't you. So when I tried to fit in and try and go with what trends were happening, it just didn't work. And I think I really learned from that. I lost a lot of money, but I learned so much from that experience that, Anisha, you've got to do what's true to you, because that's when things resonate and that's when things work.
I'd love to know, what sort of designs did you create for that particular exhibition versus what you create now?
So I was trying to do very small, like simple pieces, fine, demi-fine jewelry.
Right.
It was like very, I guess, Western shapes as well. I was trying to have this, like, you know, like Indian flair to it that I have in all my work, but it was very forced. When I did it, I really remember the feeling of creating that collection, and deep down I knew it wasn't me, but pushing through that to think, actually, this is what people want, so this is what I should be doing. And I think that comes with that confidence, things, having confidence in your ideas and kind of what your heart and your intuition is telling you what to do. And now when you see my work and the designs that I followed, it's very, very much like something that I'm super excited about, something that makes me really happy when I'm creating it. And that comes through to the other person who's receiving that work, because you're feeling all that energy that I put into it.
Yeah. So it's like, rather than trying to appeal to the masses on a pretty surface level, you hone in on a niche audience that is like craving your designs.
Exactly.
I love that because I think that's the kind of mentality which will actually bring something new, right, into the world. And I actually don't think I've seen your designs, like, I've not seen anything like it before, which I think is very nice you know, it's very refreshing.
Yeah, I think, like, laser cut jewelry has become so popular and there's so many brands doing it. But I think what I always say, it's so great that we can all have our own interpretation of it. And mine is, I guess, like, I like to think people think of it as a piece of art that you're wearing.
Yeah. Or you could wear like a really basic outfit and then just like a pop color.
Exactly. And you can wear it with your everyday work clothes or your Western wear, but then it translates to your South Asian wear as well. And I love that, because when people are buying it, they've got outfits in mind that, you know, Western and South Asian outfits that they want to wear it with. And I love that you can buy my jewelry and have that transferable kind of mode to it.
Also, with the rise of Gen Z, I feel like they're very bold and unabashedly proud of, you know, their background. And I want to take it back to younger Anisha, because I think it's a good segue. What was your upbringing like? What was your relationship like with your own identity and heritage when you were growing up?
I think growing up in Wembley, and you know, Wembley's very multicultural, very South Asian. I just never thought I stood out, like kind of unapologetically me. And I grew up in like a, you know, East African Gujarati household where adornment was like in every nook of our house. Mm. But interestingly, my parents were working in retail, and then they started their own menswear business at around the time I was a toddler. Mm-hmm. In Piccadilly Arcade, very posh British like tailoring shop. And I remember spending weekends there with them, where they were putting on this almost mask, almost like, you know, dad Pravin became Peter.
Oh.
And like, it was almost like we have to be very, very British and very mm-hmm. English. And, you know, we can't show our cultural identity because we're going to, you know, get a backlash. And I think it was crazy to me to have that experience, but then come back to Wembley and then it was very Indian. It was almost like they let their masks down finally. And then we had this very Indian Gujarati like household. So I think the contrast of that really informed who I was.
Right.
And I think that's why I was so adamant that if I was going to do work, and all the artwork I did was about exploring my Indian identity, because I think they had to shun it away so much to fit in, to assimilate in order to survive.
Yeah.
And I was very, very adamant that I didn't want to do that. I remember there was a time like with my brand, mom goes to me like, you know, bless her, she's incredibly supportive. But remember she said, Anisha, your work's not going to sell if it's about your culture. Mm-hmm. And if you want it to sell, you need to get somebody who's white to sell it for you.
Interesting. Yeah.
And that broke me. And me being me, I was almost like, I'm going to prove you wrong. So I think... Yeah, jewelry, adornment, the way in which we dressed at home in Wembley was just so like proud.
Mm.
But I also saw the other side of how they had to run their business in order to survive.
Yeah.
And I think being with my bars, both my bars, my nanny and my dad's mum, that I call Bar, London Bar and Leicester Bar, is what I called them. Leicester's where my mum grew up and like before she moved and got married. So I had a lot of family in Leicester and spent a lot of my holidays with them. Very, you know, like British Asian, very multicultural. That really informed my childhood, and I was always creative. I was always creating something.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. What sort of things did you like to create when you were younger?
Drawing, painting, like I think my outlook on life was always creative. I think when there was stuff going on at home, you know, arguing or like just stuff going on at home, I remember just being in my bedroom listening to music and painting. I've still got all the paintings that I did when I was younger. It was my way of escaping, I think, a little bit as well. It was me creating my own imaginary world to where things were beautiful, things were colourful, things were full of pattern. And that really formed a safe space for me to build, I guess, who I am today. It saved me in many ways, I think.
Mm, wow.
I don't think I've ever thought about that until I've just said that now. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So you basically infused colour into areas where you saw darkness.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so you were kind of privy to this constant code switching, basically.
Yeah, constant. Yeah.
And was there a point where it flipped in your mind and you were like, actually, no, I'm predominantly very proud of my heritage and, you know, I'm just going to celebrate it all the time. Was there a moment?
I don't think there was a moment. Maybe it was because I spent so much time with my bars, and they were just innately so like rooted in like our Gujarati culture, going to the temple.
Mm.
It was just a given. Mm. So I think maybe that shunned me away from it, and I was living in their world a little bit, where they were wearing their saris and they were wearing their gold bangles and chains and like kind of dressing me up. I remember like my bar in Leicester like folding a sari in half when I was little, and draping it on me and us going to the shops for me to buy sweets and things like that. So I think I was almost living in their unapologetic world, and that from the get-go made me so proud of my culture. So I didn't I guess I didn't have the need to assimilate. It was only really when I moved to Derby that I really felt any form of racism, because growing up in London, you just don't feel like you stick out. I don't know if you feel that, but yeah, it's just like a given.
Mm.
But it's only when I moved to Derby, like a smaller town, that I really felt, oh gosh, like I stick out here in a lot of these creative spaces. I'm the only person of colour.
Mm.
And that's really when things changed for me in the way that I viewed myself and kind of my role in the world and the work that I do. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting.
Does that make sense? Sorry, I think I went on a tangent there.
I think it makes absolute sense that I think growing up in an environment where you were constantly surrounded by other South Asians, it was actually not a case of, oh, I was surrounded by white
fitting
people.
In.
It wasn't that. It was that there was a bit more nuance to it, where when you got out of that, you were like, oh, wait, hold on a minute.
Exactly.
I'm not in a majority.
And yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So moving on to your education, were you always kind of in the arts and kind of creative sort of subjects? Like, was that always the thing that you pursued? What did you go on to study?
Yeah, so I always remember being in the art block when I was at school. So like definitely like my world and education revolved around arts. But I was also like quite a clever kid. Like I got like 4 A's on my A-level. And like, you know, I remember I did English, maths, art and economics for my AS.
So eclectic.
Yeah, because I had no idea. Because I knew my parents wanted me to do something really smart.
Yeah.
Because they'd struggled and they'd done, you know, had like a business and stuff. And that was not the route that they really wanted for me. It was like, you know, and I was the first person on my dad's side of the family to go to university. So it was kind of really important.
Mm.
I don't come from an educational background. My parents both didn't go to school after they were 15. So education, there was huge importance on that, like you are one hope sort of thing. I knew that art was something I wanted to do, but I also felt their expectations. And when I got 4 A's at AS, I remember my mom like calling the school and being like, can she apply for Oxford and Cambridge, like, you know, and kind of secretly getting them to push me towards that way. But art is what I wanted to do. And even at university, there was Route A and Route B when we applied, and Route B was Art Foundation, and Route A I applied for all business management.
Interesting.
And I got into all of them.
And then?
And I rejected all my offers to do my art foundations. My parents were livid.
Wow.
And they were just livid with me, because I think they just had all these hopes that, you know, for them, financial security was everything. Kanisha's going to, you know, be better and become a doctor or, you know, whatever.
Mm.
And that didn't happen. And I pursued art. I went to Loughborough to do my art foundation. I did multimedia textiles at Loughborough University. And then I did my master's at London College of Fashion, came back to London in MA Fashion Artifact, which was almost like conceptual fashion accessories. Then I worked in industry.
You worked at Gucci.
Yes, as a very junior designer in watches and eyewear in their only like London design office. And it was amazing. It was a very small team of 3. The people who I worked with were lovely. And it was like, I made it. Look, mum and dad, I made it. I'm working at Gucci as a designer. Like, the money's not great, but look, I'm going to, you know, work my way up. And I thought I was sorted. I genuinely thought that was it. That was my career path sorted. But about 8 months into that, they changed their creative director and they made my team redundant. And that was heartbreaking for me. But at the same time, that's what propelled me to start my business.
Right.
So it was post that I was already like kind of making my own jewelry pieces and doing my own thing kind of.
Mm.
But it was that forced, like almost propelled me to develop that first jewelry collection, shoot it, and then set up at Spitalfields. And then I guess the rest is history. Yeah.
So going back to that moment where you had been told you had just been made redundant.
Yeah.
What went through your mind?
I remember sitting in this huge boardroom and just bawling my eyes out. I was just crying because I literally thought this was my life. Like, this is what I had worked so hard to do. And it was so rare to see somebody who looked like me in luxury fashion at that time. It's so different now. But I did this off my own back, not because I had connections, not because of anything. I applied. My portfolio was good. I did this off my own back and I was so gutted that, I just didn't know what to do. And I applied for lots of jobs after that. But even with Gucci on my CV, I just didn't get any jobs.
Hmm.
It was really hard at the time. But yeah, I kind of used that energy into developing my own thing and slowly growing my own business. So, and I think the naivety when you're young to just go for stuff, the risk taking that you do at that time.
Yeah.
It's amazing actually, because I always think back to that Anisha, and she was so bold and she was so fearless.
Mm.
And I think I've got a lot to learn from that Anisha still. I want to bring that back in me a little bit. But yeah, I love that about her, that she just went for it.
Mm.
Yeah.
She rose from the ashes, basically.
Literally, yeah.
Yeah. Naivety is an interesting thing, because I feel like for anybody, and you can, you know, tell me if I'm wrong here, but when I was in my early 20s, I would spend ages consuming like business content and like who's on Forbes and, you know, all these things. And like, I'm going to start my own business and I'm not going to work for anyone. And then I realized, wait, I need to pay my rent. So let me get a job first.
Yeah.
And then I'll figure all the other stuff out. But like, I don't think I let myself be naive and like really act on that at the time. But you, as somebody who did, do you think that you would do it again if you were in that position?
Oh, that's such a good question. Yeah. I think I had the luxury of living at home with mum and dad.
Mm.
There wasn't that rent to pay. Like that, I have to say, hold my hands up, privileged position to be in.
Mm.
You know, I was living at home in London with mum and dad. I had my studio there at home.
Mm.
You know, I remember getting my first order from the V&A Museum, and it was for 500 pieces. And I said, yes.
That was your first order?
That was my first order at a wholesale trade show. And I remember going, yeah. And I had the worst cold and flu. I remember it so clearly, and me being like, yeah, sure, I can do this. But getting everybody to help me make it and put the whole thing together. The quality had issues. There were so many issues with it, but I did it. The fact is, I said yes, I did it, and I learned as I was doing it.
Yeah.
Looking back, would I have done that in a smarter way, been more prepared? Yeah, of course. But I learned so much from it. So yeah, maybe not. Maybe I'd still do it the same way all over again. It really helped me learn a lot of lessons that I'm embedding into my business now.
Mm.
So yeah.
I like that answer.
Yeah
I love that you're like, yeah, do it anyway.
Yeah,
despite the ups and downs, you know, you've been through.
Gosh, like, that's been quite hard. Powerful. Yeah, running your own business like is not easy. It's not the easy route to take. Like, it's really not. But I can't see myself doing anything else.
Mm.
I really feel like in my heart, I feel like this is what I'm meant to do.
Mm.
Yeah.
What about the all the other aspects of running a business? You know, the financial aspect, the legal aspect. Is that, you know, do you get help with that? Like, how do you manage all of that? And do you actually enjoy that aspect of it?
I think that's the almost hardest part of it, because I'm a creative, so I would love to just solely be creative, but that is not what I spend most of my time doing. Mm. The juggling, the financial part of it, the marketing part of it, the admin side of it. For the majority of me running my business, I've done a lot of it on my own. And I make everything. I hand make everything.
Oh my gosh. Really? Even now?
Yeah, even now. I have freelance makers who help me. I had an assistant last year part-time who was in the studio helping me make... And over time, I've learned I can't do everything. So having freelancers who I love working with help me has been amazing, because, you know, like, I've got Gavia, who helps me with my marketing stuff sometimes. And she's great at copy. You know, I've said I'm being dyslexic. That's helped so much.
Mm.
Being able to just speak at somebody, but they extract it and make it sound beautiful. That's been so helpful.
Mm.
And yeah, just calling on support when you need it,
mm.
you know, whether that's freelancers, whether that's collaborators, that's really helped. Working with photographers and videographers, Chevy, who I work with so much, who's from Derby, and he's from Derby. I met him in Derby and he moved to London, so we swapped. But working with him has been amazing. So I think letting letting your pride down a little bit. Initially, it's like a survival thing. I've got to be really savvy because I can't afford to hire lots of people. But over time, I've learned, let that pride down and kind of invest in your business and get the support you need, because what you're really good at is what you should be doing. And you need to get other people who are really good to fill those gaps in.
Yeah. It's. I think it's a point I've reached as well.
Yeah.
With my projects and my work, because I'm like you. I have to do everything. Everything has to go through me, because it's such a, like, I think when you're creating something of your own, you have a gut instinct that you're following, right? So you can't describe that to anyone that easily, and it takes so much effort, right?
Yeah.
I had a very similar experience recently trying to create actually a promotional trailer for one of the episodes I've released. And I remember hiring a freelancer, and you know, I was like, I need to trust this process. I need to just teach this person how to, like, you know, whatever my vision is. I can't even tell you what my vision was. It was shambles.
Yeah.
I struggled. And then I made it myself, and I was like, I can't keep doing this.
That's it. I think like finding the right people and taking time in that.
Yeah.
Because like, I think I've learned, I want to work with people who truly understand the message behind the brand. Because if you don't understand that, you're not going to understand how to, how I want things done, or how, what the messaging is.
Mm.
The messaging and like kind of the foundation of the brand has to be all the way through everything you do. So you might not always find the right person, but keep trying because there will be somebody who believes in what you do as much as you.
Mm.
Yeah.
Even more than the messaging, it is also the essence and the soul of what you're trying to create, right?
Exactly.
That's something that I think it takes time to get people on board. But I agree with you. I think there are people out there. It's just having the patience, right, to find them and hone them and train them.
Yeah, and invest in them as well.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going from a creative to a business owner, I feel like sometimes those things are so mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
How do you juggle that like dichotomy in your head? Because genuinely, it's like one thing is running a business, marketing, you know, pushing the brand, selling it. And then there's the creating, the actual like in your studio.
It's hard. I can't say I've like cracked it at all by any means. Have I like gone, yeah, this is how you do it? Because I still don't think I've got it right. But I think what actually was a pivotal point for me with that was during lockdown,
mm-hmm.
I started showing up and telling my story. So before lockdown, that whole faking it till you make it. Anish Palmer London, we're a studio, we're a team. There was no team. It was just me.
It's the girl.
It's me, Anisha. There's one person. So I was trying to seem as if I was this like whole put together business. And I think as soon as I showed up authentically and started going, it is me, I make everything, this is my story, this is my journey, that's when things started to change for me. And that's when I started to see like marketing and all the other aspects of my business so differently, because I was like, it's not a chore if I'm just being honest with who I am and what my capabilities are and what I can do as one person. Mm. If I'm honest about it, if I'm telling people the truth, then they're on that journey with me. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I started taking people on the journey with me and being honest, you know, there's times where I haven't brought out a new collection because my well-being's not been that great, or I haven't been able to release something for a certain deadline. But just being honest about that, like being dyslexic, I only found out I was dyslexic last year. But again, communicating that, I make typos in my newsletters and what I put out on social media all the time.
Mm.
And I get really embarrassed about it. But actually sharing that I'm dyslexic and this is why, I can read something 10 times but still make that mistake. Being honest about it has really helped because I'm breaking down those barriers where things don't feel so difficult. So what if I make a typo? It doesn't change the essence of what I'm saying. Or the admin mistakes that I make or whatever, people are forgiving as long as you're honest.
Mm, that's very true.
Yeah. And I think that when you're running a business, it's okay to make mistakes as long as you're just authentic about them and being like, okay, we won't make the same mistake next time.
Mm.
And people are on that journey with me, so they're going to be more forgiving.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're not exactly hurting anyone with a typo. Exactly. Like you are a small business. And I think people forget, right, when they're purchasing or looking at your prices or, you know, just looking at your website, like it's very easy to then be like, oh, let me compare this to, I don't know, like ASOS.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just like, but you're comparing like a huge conglomerate to a literal person creating, and the impact you have on them by purchasing their work or, you know, their pieces yeah. is directly to them
yeah.
and to the individuals who are helping them. So I don't know, like, I don't know, maybe we all forget that. I think I forget that because I'm an ASOS shopper yeah. myself, so you know, I'm trying to be better as well, and yeah. it's not going to be perfect, but it's interesting that like you put so much pressure on yourself, because I think that's the classic like journey of being yeah. an Indian girl, isn't it? It's like constantly trying to be perfect and pristine.
Exactly. And prove wrong. In my case, it was like, I'm going to prove to you that I can do this. And over time, mm. I think when my parents saw me working hard and seeing all the things that I've been doing, mm. they're so supportive now. But it's like that proving. I think like being a brown creative is such a taboo, like still mm. I hope for like Gen Z's it's different now, and I'd like to think like there's so much more representation and examples of creatives, but like you're right, we're so hard on ourselves because we're trying to almost prove that we can do it
and prove that we're worthy of worthy. Our existence
yeah, in this yeah, world, yeah
which I think it's like so deep and dark, but actually like the crux of all of it comes down to that, right? Like trying to prove our worth as like the kids of immigrant parents
who exactly.
worked nonstop and, you know, sometimes may call us lazy because we're not great.
That's so true though. I think like I was saying to you earlier, I still see it in my parents, you mm-hmm. know, they're still going, they're still at the shop, they're still working. And my brother's in the business. It's very much a family business and there's still that hustle mentality there. But I think I've had the privilege of stepping back from that and going, actually, like if my business is an extension of me, it needs to work intuitively to how my lifestyle is.
Yeah.
And I think that worthiness and that confidence and how that shifted is kind of taking a step back and going, I'm going to do this at my own pace, and I'm going to do this at in a way that feels authentic and right for me and the way I want my lifestyle to be. Because I've never been about, I want to be like a millionaire and I want to make loads of money. If I can make a living for me and my family, pay my bills and do what I love, I've made it. Mm. And that's it. And I think that's enough for me. That whole worthiness, comparison mode, being like at the center of the industry and stuff like that, that's never really been my ambition. Mm. And that's okay. You know, it's okay not to keep up with what everybody else is doing, because essentially I'm doing me and I'm really, really happy. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ultimately, it's just feeling like you've been true to yourself, right? Yeah. Which you are doing. And also, interestingly, I think when you look back at people's stories of people who were like pretty successful, a lot of the times they were just kind of figuring it out and doing their own thing. Like,
yeah.
you know, it's not that often that, and I've consumed a lot of, you know, stories about like founders and that kind of
yeah.
thing. And it's always like it's this like really obscure like path where they've sort of just followed some sort of gut instinct. And
yeah.
it's like, you know, just keep doing what I think is right.
Yeah.
And in a way that ultimately is what allows you to make your mark,
yeah.
particularly in the community. Because I want to touch on, yes, you said, you know, you want to be happy, you want to do stuff you love, but I think you're doing more because you're actually also looking at sharing stories
yeah.
Of just, you know, different stories within our community. And I know that you started your own podcast.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit more about how Anisha Parmar London has now branched out into storytelling, and what are some of the cool projects that you've been working on?
Yeah. So I think in the last couple of years, like when I went back full time into my business, I really was trying to think about what the message of my brand here is bigger. And what is that? And how do I explore that? So I applied for the Developing Your Creative Practice grant from the Arts Council to really find out who is Anisha Parmar as an artist, because the crux of who I am is an artist. So, you know, I was so grateful that I got awarded that, because with that, I was able to explore kind of storytelling through jewelry. I kind of developed my jewelry brand looking at, the first collection was looking at my grandma's jewelry pieces. When she passed away when I was 12, I inherited her gold jewelry pieces, being the only girl on my dad's side of the family. I always felt this innate connection to her. There was this strong connection to her, but I never really knew why. And when I inherited those pieces, it was almost like I was piecing together her story through these jewelry pieces I was seeing. I was feeling her energy. And I thought, there's other people out there who have these gold jewelry pieces that are locked away in lockers or forgotten about. They must have stories behind them. So I really want to document them before they're lost, because I didn't get a chance to do that with my grandma. So I did a call out as part of this project to do with the Arts Council and funding I got. And I called it Empowered Adornment Gold Jewelry Stories. And I asked my social media following, if you've got a gold jewelry story, I want to hear it. And I got inundated with people going, I can't believe nobody's ever asked us. We've got these jewelry pieces. We've got this. We want to tell you about them. And this was during COVID as well. And we were still like just coming out of lockdown. So a lot of my interviews were done over Zoom, where people who reached out to me were opening, you know, their velvet boxes, their most precious pieces over Zoom and showing me. And a lot of these people I didn't even know, but they trusted me enough to do that. And I just felt so privileged that they wanted to tell me their story. And, you know, through them showing me these pieces, we found out stories of partition, how pieces survived and didn't, pieces that didn't make it through Sri Lankan Civil War. We talked about like a piece from a grandmother that was worn by the mother and then the granddaughter for the wedding, East African migration, like my own family. So many stories about, you know, how these pieces traveled to the UK, but how they're now relevant in the diaspora. And I just felt so lucky that I got to do that, because I think that became a podcast series, that became like written journals that I wrote about the significance of gold jewelry specifically in the diaspora. That became an exhibition, and then that led me on to being a project producer at Derby Museum, where I worked with culturally diverse women of Derby, a small group of us that got together to look at their world cultures gallery. So within that, there's pieces from all around the world, and as we know, a lot of these pieces in the museums and organizations in the UK are rooted in colonialism, empire and slavery. So for me, I really wanted to think about how can we decolonize these pieces, but actually with working with the community and talking about our shared history, learning from each other, and actually making these objects that have been kind of lost and forgotten about behind cases feel at home. So that was amazing for me, because, you know, we as like a group of women were talking about quite dark, heavy things, but we were supporting each other. So we didn't take that heaviness away with us. And what we essentially were doing were decolonizing these pieces by treating them with love, talking about them with love. And the pieces were actually worn by the women, the pieces that they resonated with, that were either from their culture or told parts of their story. They wore those pieces for the first time in I don't know how many years. And that was a co-produced photo shoot. So that was really special to me to do. And it really got me to see how jewelry and the material culture of jewelry is so different to any other object because of how we wear it so close to the body and the energy that it carries. And I think that energy, not many people or academics or in, you know, when we think about museums might understand that, but I think it's so visceral in the way that it's deep rooted in our culture, how we respect things, you know, how we respect idols when we go to the temple, or how we respect, you know, gold jewelry like this bangle that my grandma gave me. I wear it every single day and I feel her with me. We understand that in a different way because how spiritually we've grown up and how our ancestors have respected objects and things, if that makes sense. So I guess that's led me on to my latest project, working with the National Trust, working at Kedleston Hall, which is a local National Trust property to Derby, where I am. And it was owned by the ex-Viceroy of India, Lord Curzon. And he has this museum in his ground floor, which is a dark, really dark, horrible space. But he's got all these objects which he collected through his travels before being a viceroy and whilst he was a viceroy. And I was, I guess, invited as a guest curator to look at the jewelry pieces in his collection. And I worked with incredible like collaborators, Ophile, photographer, Kesha Reitha, dancer, choreographer, the Garawa twins, to think about how can we make these pieces feel at home and make them feel like they belong in a place they were never meant to be. And there was a quote by Lord Curzon's wife, Mary Curzon, where she called them her Rani of Jodhpur while she was visiting her painted jawed female prisoner. And it infuriated me because she used the way she was adorned as a way to show that she was oppressed, like covered in heavy emeralds, anklets of weight. So she talked about all the jewelry pieces she was wearing as like shackles almost. And what we did in our collaboration as part of this project, Kesha took on the form of the Maharani of Jodhpur, and the Garhwa twins wrote a special word, spoken word piece and music piece, taking on almost like the voice of the Maharani of Jodhpur coming to Kedleston and going, my adornment isn't oppressive and I'm going to tell you why. And she moves through the stately floor, adorning herself in these pieces that were part of the museum, first time it ever really ever happened, ever having objects being worn in the National Trust like that. That's never happened before, and these pieces were probably not worn for over 100 years. So the weight of doing, like, we all felt the gravity and the importance of what we were doing. And I think organizations like the Trust have a long way to go in understanding the emotional burden it takes to do projects like this. But I'm so glad we did it, because it's really powerful seeing, you know, visitors like being there and visitors who really get it, people who've joined and become, you know, National Trust members, an Indian family coming with like their young kids, became specifically for this project and joined and became members because of this, because they felt like they belonged in a space that was oppressive and which they never felt like they belonged before. And I think that is the reason why I've been doing the work I've been doing recently. So yeah, I went on for a long time about that, but it's really important. Yeah.
I've never heard of, and maybe this is my own ignorance, but I've never heard of a project like this in a museum where, you know, obviously artifacts that were clearly stolen during partition or like during colonialism, during like the British Raj, to be like celebrated in this way. I've never heard of it kind of, you know, transformed into a positive story or like put in a positive light of, yes, okay, yeah, we were stolen, but we're here, we're still beautiful, and we still have our story. And we're going to celebrate that, even though we're in an unfamiliar territory. And that in itself is so powerful. Like, I can't imagine how you would have, you know, kept yourself together whilst doing this project, because it feels like a lot of responsibility. You're right.
Huge responsibility. I felt that, you know, the objects to me were almost like human beings. I was treating them with that respect. And explaining to an organization why it was so important for these being worn, and constantly pushing back at these systems and structures that weren't built for things like this to take place. It was tough. I was constantly, I guess, like I've learned my role to push back and challenge through this project. Was really important, because this work needs to be done, and there needs to be more people doing work like this, because I think our experience of the diaspora, how we're always, I guess, towing between two worlds or feeling displaced, you know, not feeling like we really belong in certain situations or in certain spaces, is how we really identify with these objects, because they're displaced.
Yes.
They're in a place that they were never meant to be. They're uprooted from their, you know, root culture, just like we are. So we identify with them in a completely different way, and having more of those perspectives in museums and national organizations is so important, because I say this all the time, like the little Anisha never went to museums, but now if that little Anisha goes to a museum and sees herself represented, like, I've done my job, I've lived my purpose, because that is what I want to do. I think I want to see representation and hopefully beautiful, true representation of different stories in these spaces. Our voices need to be heard. There needs to be power shifts. We need to speak up. We need to push back, because the people who are in power have been in power for a really long time. And if we don't challenge, if we don't speak up, as exhausting and emotionally draining as it is, nothing's going to change.
Absolutely. And I think we need to stop lying about our histories.
Totally. I mean, I didn't know about empire history until like my adult life, you know. I never learned it in school. I didn't know like the truth of Empire. I had a rose tinted view on it. My first collection was called the Empire Collection with that rose tinted view, you know. So it's only really recently learning my own history and learning the truths of what's happened has made me go, whoa, there's so much of breaking down of structures that needs to be done. It's so ingrained. And yeah, I feel like more recently that's been my role, is challenging those structures. Yeah.
So going back to when you said that, you know, you just want to do what you enjoy and be happy and create something nice, you are doing so much more than that. And I think from an entire sort of community perspective, I want to thank you from all of our behalf, because I know it's like dramatic to say, but actually, like, we need more people like you doing this work, because we really don't know what our history actually holds. And so much of it was erased as well, that like the little amount that's left, at least we can like, you know, learn about that and get to know about that and see the truth for what it really is. Because it doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to all move away from the UK and be like, oh no, this, no, but it's like actually living with awareness, like going to museums with that awareness.
Yeah.
This is where this thing came from. And I'm going to appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I definitely think there's a shift in like museum spaces and the way that they share that real story through interpretation, through working with more artists like me. There is a shift happening, but it needs to be, I guess, I feel like it always seems to be in short-term projects because the funding's so short-term. I wish it was ingrained more in what museums did, because I mean, I didn't grow up going to museums. My parents never took me to museums unless it was at school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just hope, and I think that's because they didn't see themselves represented in those spaces. And if they did, I think museums and cultural spaces could be such a great way to bring together communities and learn. Yeah.
Absolutely. So what are you working on next?
So homeware collection, like I said, that's coming together slowly. So I'm hoping to release that before Diwali and Christmas. Like, doing up my home and interior design has been something that I've loved. Creating that safe space in Derby where I live has been amazing. It's been like an extension of my creativity. So homeware is something I've wanted to do for a really, really long time. It's just a small collection, but it's really pretty. I'm really happy with the way it's coming together. And then I want to do more project work. You know, the last few projects I've done have been really heavy. And well-being and creating a safe space again to do work like this is really important. But I really want to keep doing work like this, working with organizations to bring together more stories, so they give more people and more artists like me a platform to share our stories. I want to do more work around the link of jewelry, adornment and identity. It's like, yeah, it's something that I love doing, but also think it's really important. I feel like it's my purpose.
Do you think that there is an increasing shift in the way that people view jewelry within South Asian communities? Because obviously, like, it's something that's given at weddings, you know, it's part of your, let's say, asset collection, especially as a woman. Do you see that kind of shifting now?
I think so. I think there was a time where like yellow gold was so like, oh, I'd never wear that. Like, I never want to wear that. We were embarrassed by it. We were so embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
And I think there's definitely more awareness in kind of the memories that these pieces hold, and us wanting to cherish them for the future. Yeah, of course, there's a monetary value in it. But I think, and obviously there's that link to dowry and that very traditional kind of like financial transaction between the boy side and the girl side. But historically, gold was given to your daughter as her financial security. If anything were to happen, she could, you know, use that for her own security to get away from a bad situation. And I think now for us being our own financial security, it's the material culture value, the memory value that means so much to us. And there's definitely way more awareness of it. And there's also so many amazing South Asian jewelry brands out there killing it.
It's true.
Taking the essence of that gold jewelry piece
mm.
and presenting it in new, incredible ways. Mm. Yeah.
I love that. And I love that we're starting to kind of embrace that side of it again, because yeah. I do remember very distinctly saying, I will never wear gold yeah. ever in my life.
Yes.
So no, I love it for us. And I guess a couple final questions yeah. for you. One being for somebody who is, you know, potentially looking to start their own thing.
Yeah.
And it is at that crux, you know, where maybe they're looking to quit a job, maybe they've been made redundant, maybe they're just starting off in their career and they're not sure whether it's in this economy, it's too scary to start their own thing. What would you say to them?
Do it. I'd say go for it. If you can and you're financially able to make it work, I genuinely believe if you feel in your core that that's what you're meant to be doing,
mm.
once you make space and time for it, the universe will support you in doing that. That things will fall into place. The more energy, the more time you put into honing your craft and making it your sole purpose mm. and making it your focus, the universe supports you in doing that. I've truly found that, you know, since I've been doing it in the last like 4 years full time and put everything into it, the opportunities, the support, the learnings of my craft and getting better at it, all of that has come. So if you can and you kind of innately believe, I think this is what I should be doing, if you know that deeply, go for it. Try not to get caught up in comparing. Try not to get caught up in this is the way it should be done because this is how businesses are run.
Right.
Don't feel like you have to be perfect and have everything together before you release stuff. Take your customers and people who you think, you know, your business will appeal to on that journey with you. Mm-hmm. Be honest about who you are, about the journey you're going on, and the right people will resonate with that. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And don't forget that we all have different levels or yeah. privilege as well, right?
Totally. Yeah. I think for me, like I said, I was living at home with my parents mm. and that really helped me. But I think, you know, yeah, if financial security is something that you're worried about, of course you need that job, but maybe it's a part-time job so you can spend some time. You can focus your energy mm. on it on the other days. Yeah, mm.
There's a way to make it work.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
I think like we do kind of get caught up sometimes in making excuses and in inertia because we're too scared to start. Mm. But the truth is that like I did it a different way to
That's
you.
It.
You know,
that's and, it. Yeah.
And I'm still not at a point where like I'm, you know, doing this full time, or I don't even know if I will reach a point. Yeah. But I think the point is that just get started and like yeah. you did and like we're all doing.
You make it work. I think you're like the best example of that. I think like, yeah, you juggle so much. And I guess like my question for you is this what you want to do full time?
Mm, that's a great question. No. And the reason being that I have recently discovered that I may have ADHD tendencies. And so for me, I actually need to always be doing different things.
Yeah.
And I actually think it works for me not to put all my eggs in one basket. In a sense, you do the same because you're not just a jewelry brand.
Yeah.
You're doing many other things. I reckon I'd get bored if I just did one thing. But never say never. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe one day I'll just be, you know, just doing different little things of my own and
yeah.
and somehow making it work and trusting the process. So we'll find out.
Yeah.
Last question for you, Anisha, is what do you have strong game in?
Oh, what do I have strong game in? I think it's my purpose. I think it's using jewelry as a mode to tell stories, document stories, people like us, our stories before they're lost. And creating a safe space for people to have these conversations, and hopefully through the work, it being shown, people feeling like they're hopefully represented, breaking down structures,
mm.
and obviously to adorn people in amazing jewels.
Yes.
It's my strong game. But also just like knowing that I'm on my own journey and my own path, and
Being kind to myself, I think now is my strong game. Yeah.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your story here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me this platform. I think a lot of realizations have come up.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? What can happen when you just start like thinking back and opening up?
Yeah.
Because we often don't look back at our journeys, do we? We're just plodding on. But no, you're amazing. You're doing amazing
as
things.
As are you. Yeah. It's amazing to, I think, through your podcast to learn about other, I guess, brown people's stories and to see just success in different ways, in different forms. I think I know I've resonated with so many of your episodes. And yeah, I hope people resonate with my journey as well.
They 100%. I mean, you've already got one person who's like, whoa, yeah, I need to like reevaluate. But no, thank you once again. And I wish you all the best with your projects. You're so like intricate and thoughtful with how you tell your stories and the kind of projects that you're taking on. It's really refreshing to see. It's amazing because I do think we live in a world right now where attention spans are very short and everyone's kind of trying to jump onto the next trend. And among that, you know, looking back to our histories, our stories, and just honoring our culture in the way that, you know, we think it deserves to be honored. I feel like you're doing that and you're, you know, striving for that. So keep going, power to you.
Thank you so much.
I hope a lot of people like kind of try and follow in those footsteps as well.
Oh, that means the world to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Brown Game Strong. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to stick around, then please do hit the subscribe button if you're listening on YouTube. And do give the social links a follow as well. We're on Instagram and on TikTok. If you have any thoughts, feedback, advice, any potential guests that you'd like to hear me speak to, then please do drop a note on either the socials or on browngamestrong@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening and really appreciate your support.